All right. Hello, everyone. Thank you all for coming. My name is Steve Karpinski. I'm the marketing director with Michigan Radio, 91.7 FM here in Detroit and southeastern Michigan. Thank you all for coming. If you just happen to stumble in here and you're wondering what's going on, this is one of our Issues and Ale events. I assume most of you came here for a reason and not just that you heard they have really good wings here, which is true. So Issues and Ale is a discussion series that we host in Michigan Radio, talking about issues that are going on all across Michigan. And we try to do these in an informal atmosphere, places like Traffic Jam. We do them in comedy clubs, brew pubs, all over the place. This is the first time here in Midtown, first time actually at Traffic Jam. So we appreciate all of you coming out. I see a couple of familiar faces here. And if this is your first time at a Michigan Radio Issues and Ale event, I want to thank you very much for coming out. I have a couple announcements before we get started with the program. First off, a big thank you to Traffic Jam, the folks here who made the venue available to us to use for tonight's event. And tonight's Issues and Ale is also co-sponsored by the Detroit Free Press. We want to thank them for their support of our Issues and Ale event tonight. We do have some other Issues and Ale events coming up soon in a couple weeks. We're going to be getting into politics mode. We have an event coming up on Tuesday, August 12th in Ann Arbor at Bill's Beer Garden, which is right downtown Ann Arbor, outdoors. Our It's Just Politics team of Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta will be there. And we're going to be talking politics. It'll be the week after Michigan's primary election next week, and we'll be sort of recapping what happened in the primaries, looking ahead towards the November election, looking at the ballot issues, and finding out what the state legislature is up to and all sorts of stuff. So if you have a chance, join us for that. And then we'll be back in Metro Detroit in September for some events, again, looking ahead at the fall election. So we hope you'll join us for that. If you want to keep up to date on what's going on with Michigan Radio events and our Issues and Ale events, you can always check out our website at michiganradio.org. You can follow us on Facebook or Twitter. Or on your tables, you have these little pads like this. These are our newsletter sign-up. And if you fill out one of those forms, just leave it on your table. We'll pick those up. If you're not already on our newsletter list, it's a great way to keep up to date on events and programs that are coming up on Michigan Radio and things along those lines. And also on your table, you'll find some information on State of Opportunity. So tonight's event is part of our State of Opportunity project. State of Opportunity is a multi-year initiative that we're doing looking at sort of the root causes of poverty and childhood poverty in Michigan and things that can be done to address that situation in Michigan. We have several members of our State of Opportunity team here. Sarah Alvarez is here doing some live tweeting. If you're on Twitter, we're there. You can use the hashtag State of Op or hashtag Issues and Ale, A-N-D, Ale. So that's going on. Let's see what else. We have a State of Opportunity call-in show coming up later this week. Are you going to talk about that? Okay. So I'll let the star of the show talk about that. Let's see. I think that's it for the housekeeping kind of stuff. Our host today is Jennifer White. You know Jen as our All Things Considered host on Michigan Radio. Jen got the day off from All Things Considered today. So she could be down here and host our discussion tonight. So we appreciate Jennifer doing that. And without further ado, Jennifer White.
Good evening, everyone. This is a much different experience for me and that I actually get to talk to faces as opposed to a beige wall, which is how I spend much of my time. So it's good to talk to real-life people for a change. How many of you are familiar with State of Opportunity, that project? Okay, good. As Steve explained, we were fortunate enough to receive a multi-year grant from the Kellogg Foundation to look at how to make Michigan a place where all kids have a chance to succeed. As you know, perhaps 25% of Michigan children live in poverty, and that number is appalling. When you think about what it means to live in poverty, most people think about a lack of resources, food, shelter, maybe a lack of educational opportunities. But one thing that people don't often think about is the degree of trauma and violence many of these children are exposed to and what that does to their development emotionally, mentally, physiologically, there's a real impact. So on Thursday, we'll be having a call-in show to talk about this issue from a number of different directions, but we wanted to also have this conversation out in the community to give you a chance to talk to us about what you see and to hear from some of the people who are working in this sector, to hear about their experiences. And our hope with these events is that you take what you learn here and you take it out to where you live. I was talking to a colleague today, and she covered a very difficult story, and she said, it's so hard because I don't feel like I'm moving the needle. And she said, I don't know what to do about that. And I said, well, she said, the people who come to events and the people who listen to the reports, they're the choir, right? We're talking to people who are already engaged in this. And I said, well, what we have to do is rely on the choir to talk to the non-choir members. So if you're here, I'm sort of assuming you're part of the choir. You're part of the group that's interested in what happens to all kids in Michigan. And so my challenge to you, in addition to just listening and learning during this event, is that you take it outside of these doors and continue this conversation and whatever action you think is appropriate beyond these doors. So I want to start just as a framework, and it's been a Monday, you guys. It really has been. I have a tablet, but I dropped it when I got here, so I'm reading this off of my iPhone. But I wanted to just, before I introduce our panelists, start with this Facebook post that a friend received. He posted. He said, the 14-year-old girl that was murdered in Armada is tragic and horrible. Anytime I read the news about a teenager being killed, it really hurts my heart because I immediately think of my teenage kids. It's very hard, though, not to be a cynic when you are seeing news of this 14-year-old girl who is white and pretty everywhere. There is media coverage all over the place, and it will probably become national media coverage soon. Yet the 15-year-old black boy who was killed three blocks from my house, actually not far from here, warrants not a single blip anywhere on any news station. My neighbors were crying, scrubbing blood off the street, and they just want to know if there's any sort of news or progress on the investigation or if the shooter has been identified or caught. Just something to put our hearts and minds at ease, but because he was a young black man, nobody outside of our little neighborhood seems to care. He continues, both children were equally valuable to our world and both are equally mourned. They were both human beings, and now they're both gone. And that's the context that we find ourselves in, is that while there are thousands and thousands and thousands of children nationwide here in Michigan who are suffering from trauma every day, there don't seem to be adequate resources to help them overcome that trauma and perhaps break the cycle of violence we seem to be locked in so many communities. So with that, I'd like to welcome our panelists who are going to help us tackle this evening. First, I'd like to welcome Eric Howard. He's founder of Detroit's The Alley Project. He's also joined by Naija Valdez and Freddie Diaz. Eric, if I can get you to join me up here. I'd also like to welcome Jim Henry from Western Michigan University's Children's Trauma Assessment Center. Jim, if I could have you join me. Thank you for being here. You made quite a trek. I appreciate it. Finally, Carl Taylor, a Detroit native and a nationally prominent urban scholar and sociology professor at Michigan State University. Carl, thanks for joining us. So, Jim, I actually want to start with you. You know, we talk about the impact violence and trauma has on kids and on their brain development. Can you kind of walk us through what happens when you're in a position of perhaps feeling like you're always in that fight or flight mode? What does that do to the brain?
So, recognizing that our brains are affected by our environment, and what happens is not just, you know, we have this kind of perception that it's over, yet it stays in our brain, all right? And so what we know in research, this is the most amazing thing, is over the last 15 years, research has told us that the brain changes when it's chronically exposed to toxic stress and or significant trauma. And those kind of are similar things, yet toxic stress can be something like being in poverty day in, day out, or being exposed to neighborhood violence. And trauma can certainly, that individual experience of being overwhelmed, helpless, feeling like I don't know what's going to happen next, and therefore the brain goes into what we call the fight-flight. And so what happens is that the higher regions of the brain, which is what we call our prefrontal cortex, where we think, we're all around here, and we think, and we're listening. And so this is the highest region of the brain. But what happens when you're chronically exposed to toxic stress or trauma is that the middle region of the brain, it's called the limbic area, begins to be affected, and that becomes overdeveloped. And so you can't reach the higher regions of the brain. And so what happens is then trauma, toxic stress affects the limbic so that then you can't regulate, all right? So everybody in this room has learned how to regulate themselves. I'm angry, I'm confused, and yet how do you calm? And yet what trauma and toxic stress does is it overdevelops a certain region of the brain, which then consequently then affects my ability to think in a higher way. So one last thing. So we are a trauma center at where we are, and we've seen about 3,500 kids from across Michigan. And what we know is that 90% of our kids that we see, and these are kids exposed to maltreatment, 90% of our kids have moderate to major attention problems, all right? 85% of our kids have moderate to major memory problems, and 80% of our kids that we see have moderate to major learning or language problems. And so you take language, you take memory and attention. And what does that spell? It spells school failure. All right. And so this is in the brain, and yet our society is always talking about kids are making bad choices, right? I mean, you think, well, you could do something different if you wanted to. And yet if your brain goes like this, you can't think through the consequences. And that's why so often people use behavior mod to try and change kids who've been chronically exposed to trauma and stress, and it doesn't work because the brain goes like this and they can't anticipate what the outcome of that is.
And so when we talk about areas where there are high concentrations of poverty and kids who are exposed to high levels of trauma, my assumption would be that most of those kids don't get access to someone like you.
Unfortunately, the answer is yes, all right? And that recognition of what we don't provide our kids, and I just want to say this, and I was struck. I was in Flint today. We have a big grant in Flint. We were working in Flint, and it's very interesting when you were talking about the parallel process of the one girl and the 15-year-old boy, but, you know, I think it was Lieutenant Governor, and I could be wrong, but somebody in Snyder's cabinet was very much connected to autism because they had a child who had autism.
Lieutenant Governor, yeah.
So we're sitting with the clinical director of community mental health, very big in Flint, and she said, it's amazing now. We have the state of the art for autism. Every county in Michigan has had to do that because that's the law. And my first thought was, but who's responding to our kids, right? Who's responding to our kids who aren't autistic? Sometimes they look that way because of many reasons, as we all know in this room. So yes, the answer is that there isn't the resource. We give the minimal, right? And then we expect kids to be successful, and oftentimes they end up in the juvenile justice system, and the research is very clear about that because they can't regulate and process. So absolutely, and let me just give you an idea. In our trauma center, and we see kids from all over Michigan, we have a one-year wait to get in to see us. Okay? So you imagine then that there's lots of kids that need it, but the money isn't there because it's not a priority.
So in your work, Carl, and you've been doing this research for a long time, how does lack of resource, lack of access to someone like Jim, how do we see that play out in the community? When a kid doesn't have access to someone who can sort of interrupt that debilitation and sort of help them learn ways to cope with what they've experienced.
Well, tough question or not a tough question. We haven't seen anything, any support, any services. I see my old college roommate who's a clinical psychologist, Dr. George Fleming over there, and I'm always calling him in the middle of the night throughout forever, saying that our children are getting absolutely nothing. These communities are just dry. And so what you see is the most monstrous acts. You see behavior that's just not fair. And it's hard to digest and make sense of it. But nobody really, it's very damning. That's all I can say, you know.
Now, Eric, you started the TAP project. And when you did, was it because you saw this playing out in the community? Do you see TAP as a way to maybe provide some resources for kids?
I do. First, I have to say, I didn't start TAP. It was a community effort, and so we'll often get called co-founders. But if we were being honest, it would be co-founder. and the reason is because the project itself is in a neighborhood, and that neighborhood has needs, and that neighborhood also has a unique set of assets. And so the Alley project is very much based on the unique needs and assets of that part of the community, hyper-locally. So sometimes we'll get asked questions about, you know, doing that somewhere else. We can take process somewhere else, but we can't take the product, you know, maybe somewhere else. And not because, oh, well, we're doing it so great and you can't do it like that. It's because it really is. It's part of the DNA of the people that it's serving, because they're all in advisory roles and, you know, helping to pick that stuff. So
for people who maybe aren't familiar with TAP, will you explain a little bit about what you do?
Sure. So the Alley Project, essentially, if you were to go there today, it would be an outdoor art environment that you could walk through, look at, you know, interact with. It's a place where people can view, create, and exhibit artwork. But it's really a lot more. And so we talk about in Detroit, sometimes there's like outside-in projects. So there's things that are going on that they have a lot of buzz, and so they draw people to the city. Like maybe you can call Comerica Park that, you know, or on a smaller scale, some other programs. We try to be inside out. And so the whole point of being inside out is that the Alley Project is more than what you see when you walk through it, because it's really a series of relationships. And we measure our success at the Alley Project by the frequency and depth of unlikely relationships that are formed through our processes. And we do that because we believe strongly in a model of social capital. And we think that it's an unlimited resource. It's a resource that you can harvest. And then after you harvest it, you can reinvest it in the development of community. And so at the Alley Project, we've done that with young people. And, you know, we think in some ways it, you know, is relevant to a topic like we're discussing tonight. But it's really about good community, you know, about good community building, building healthy community, which I think can, you know, apply to a variety of factors.
Now, Carl, like I said, you've been doing research in this area for a long time. Talk a little bit about, because, you know, we hear a lot, well, how did we end up here? How did we get to this place? What have you seen in terms of that evolution?
Well, being a native, and I mentioned it to, I was speaking to Angie earlier, and I grew up on the northwest side of Detroit, which was, they were great neighborhoods. They were working class neighborhoods. But children in the summer could go to the playground and you had any type of activity that you could possibly think of. If a kid was a nerd and he didn't want to play hardball and he couldn't play hardball, they had something for the nerd, seriously. So you had a lot of resources and children, there were community standards that you didn't get on Mrs. Wilson's grass. The Taylor boys were community property. And so all of these things were in place and working quite fine. For me, the blowout, the nuclear bomb, was the riot in 1967. When the riot hit, then the reverberations were incredible in the bad way. It's like somebody unplugged something. And so you begin to see those resources disappearing. You hear more political rhetoric. I'm struck by what you said about, I'm apolitical, but I hear the lieutenant governor who loves his child, which a lot of people love their children. They're not getting that connection. They're not getting any connection, and with all the respect over here, yes, that is there, but I have looked at year after year over the decade of, I have a group of children right now living under downtown, under Hart Plaza. There's no parent there. and they're scrabbling for food, and there's no one there to tell them left or right. I mean, seriously. And so it's something that everybody's turning their head, and the dollar is stretched and disappeared, and then people come along and say things like, well, pick yourself up by your bootstraps. You have no damn boots. I mean, you have no socks. I mean, seriously. The harshness that I'm seeing towards children, which is being really, it's glowing right now with what's taking place out west with the children coming in internationally, and they're acting like it's monsters. So it's the hopelessness is what I'm talking about. 50 years ago, there was a lot of hope for children, and if you got out of hand, someone would always feed you, someone would always protect you. It didn't have to be your child, per se. It was a community child. All of that is gone, and it's taken its toll. I feel for the kids. I didn't grow up with the ruins of Detroit. We had grass to cut. I cut that grass, and we had to cut that grass as kids, and we were paid for it. There were jobs. There was a pecking order. And now, on shows like this, many times I'll get horrible tweets that I don't even look at in the blogs. Like, you know, why don't you go back, you big ape? And they say worse. But there's so much meanness, and they don't care if it's a kid or adult. It's a very mean spirit that's taking place. So you look at the buildings. We have a lot of kids. Everybody's talking about tearing down buildings. There are a lot of children and families that are squatting. And all of them are not, you know, they're human beings. And so they act real ugly about it. Turn off the water. Turn off, I guess soon, the last thing I'll say, turn off the air. I had a kid last week, seriously, and an old guy in the neighborhood who was a retired auto worker who pointed out to me that he was a veteran. And he called me and he said, Taylor, what the hell am I supposed to do? I got a kid up here. He's trying to put air in his tire. And they want a dollar at the air pump. Air was free, and now they're charging a dollar to come out the air pump. So that shows you where we are, and it's a shameful point, I think.
Eric, in your work, do you hear these kinds of reflections from the young people you work with, or this? Are they concerned about what's happening around them, or has there been sort of a normalization of the experience?
I think yes to both, probably. Going back to what I was saying about frequency and depth of unlikely relationships, you know, a no-brainer is relationships between, say, 12 to 14-year-olds and elder neighbors, right, in their 80s. Like, that might be unlikely, but sometimes in our work, especially in the culture that we work in, we target young people that are involved or interested in street art, and our purpose is to contribute to reducing their legal and physical risk. Sometimes an unlikely relationship is a 14-year-old male from, you know, one street with a 14-year-old male, you know, from another street. So, yes, I think that's their reality. Yes, I also think that it's normalized. And I think it's strange sometimes when we're about that work of supporting and building those relationships that it's kind of seen as out of the box. And, you know, for them. And, you know, for us it's kind of a, you know, why wouldn't you have a relationship, you know, with somebody? So,
Jim, when we look at the cycle of violence, we hear that phrase a lot. Is part of why that cycle seems to be so difficult to break what you described earlier in our conversation, in that you have people, young people, who are experiencing trauma after trauma after trauma, don't have an intervention, don't have an interruption, and so they just sort of fall or feed into that cycle, and that's part of why we find ourselves where we are now.
So recognizing that all of us, including us in this room, and we're in constant danger. I mean, what we're talking about is exposure to danger. And any of us, when we're exposed to danger, we move into survival mode. Right? And so survival mode, again, is on this lower part of the brain. It's not on this thinking, let's look at the whole picture, what should I do? It's survival. Our brain is built on survival. And so when you're chronically exposed to violence, you learn to be able to survive danger. And that becomes your primary strategy. That primary push to live is to survive danger. And so you take on behaviors of your environment to be able to survive in that divide. So whether it's guns or whether it's violence, that this is how you survive.
And so we say to people in this very kind of logical way, well, you shouldn't be like that, all right? And yet if your brain is wired here for survival, you don't hear this because you're in the mode of saying, I need to protect myself. The only way I survive is if I act first because my belief is you're going to hurt me. And that context of that relationship, and you said that well about relationship, is relationships aren't safe. You know, 95% of our kids who come into our trauma center will tell you, I can't trust people, all right? And if you can't trust people, how does that affect relationships? Because I'm waiting for you to what? To betray me, to hurt me. And so, again, that puts me in constant alert. And interpreting my environment as dangerous means that I'm going to, A, either act on it first, B, flee, or the third thing that we see with some of our kids is a numbness, all right? It's a numbness to violence because I can't affect it. It overwhelms me, and so there's a numbing that if we don't feel, we can survive. And I think that's one of the tragic things about the cycle of violence is because I lose empathy. So then I hurt somebody, but I can't feel it anymore because that's how I've learned how to survive.
Carl, I see you nodding. Does that reflect what you've seen?
Yes. You see, there's so much to talk about because you have young people who fall into juvenile facilities and yet they're cut off. And you begin to see at one point in our studies, we were calling them children of the dam. I have young men who look through you. And so you start talking about being fearful. You feel it before anything happens because they've been done so bad all their life that they become alien. And so they give you the creeps because, and then they do terrible things. And I've been in places where violence is taking place. I was at a shooting years ago, and I promised this gang of females that the reward for talking that I was taking them out to eat. And a young man got shot, and he was dying, and I had freaked, you know. And so we're leaving, and the guy's dead, and I'm going towards my car, and they call me and say, where you going? I said, I'm out of here. I mean, this is not me, you know, right? They said, I won't say what they called me, but it was, a cute name. But, Negro, you coming back here and you going to feed us because you promised us to eat. And my reaction was, eat? How in the world can I eat after I just saw somebody die? And they went. I sat there and sipped on water and cried and looked at them in horror because they were eating and acting like nothing had happened. So you know something is disconnected, something bad has happened. And unfortunately, I have my colleague there, Pamela Smith, who heads up our field team here. We were just recently with some young women again, and I'm seeing some tough young women. And I'm not saying young women should be soft, but what I'm saying is that these young women were tough. I mean, they just weren't having it. And I was comparing that, which I shouldn't do because I'm old and gray, but I just looked at the difference in these children and the freedom that my generation that we had when we were hanging out, and they weren't enjoying that. And I was noting to Pamela, did you see that? Did you see this? And so there's a difference in that impact, as I'm saying, has made a drastic change to the point that what we call is the normalization of ignorance and violence. That's what we write about. We look at it all the time.
I'm hoping, and I should have mentioned this earlier, that this will not be just a discussion between the four of us. You're also invited to ask questions, share comments, ideas, thoughts. There is a wireless mic, so if you have something you'd like to share or ask anyone up here, just raise your hand. One of the things that's interesting to me about what you just described, Carl, is that breakdown. I think it makes it so much more challenging to tackle the problem, right? Because you have young people who seem to be dehumanized in a way, which makes it more difficult for the people who are writing the policies and writing the grants to engage because I try my best not to read the comment section, but sometimes I can't help myself, and then don't read the comments. But reading the comments on certain stories and what people have to say about these young, oh, they're animals. Just burn it, burn the whole place down. You know, and it's this complete disconnection from these young people as being human beings. So is there anything to do about that? How do we connect people to the understanding that these aren't just kids living in some isolated space out in the middle of nowhere? These are they're someone's children.
Well, I first have to say that we had been very successful. This was a city once that had recreation. Again, I'll go back, but it's not just recreation, but after school. This city and other urban spots have a lot of kids just roaming around, not after school because they don't go to school. There's no school to go to. And so we were doing something right at one time, and then somewhere we made a value judgment that different from what you're saying. I think there are a lot of, I'm going to get in trouble, but I think there are a lot of policy people who are not spending money in the right places and in the right way, and they use this as an excuse. And I feel very strong that there's a great deal of language behind closed doors about those people or them, and that's what they're acting on. They're showing it right now in the policies. A lot of these policies do not favor children in any sort. They don't want to feed them. They don't treat them right when they lock them up. They treat them. There's no such thing as juvenile. I spent 10 years on the Governor's Commission on Juvenile Justice. There was no juvenile justice. We have turned the juvenile facilities into mini prisons. And so the attitude towards young people, we don't even take into consideration that they are young people. I think the policies are horrible. I know I'm not getting any money anyway, but I'm telling you straight up, the policies are not moving. That's not the knock that there are people out there who are doing hard work and some are. But overall, I'm speaking of national policies are not favorable towards children in the manner that they were 50 years ago.
Sarah Alvarez and I took a trip up to Flint a couple of weeks ago to talk to some folks who were doing violence intervention work and prevention work. And in Flint, they have a single police officer. He's a staff of one, with the exception of those volunteers he can recruit, who works on youth violence prevention and interruption for Flint. One guy, and he's trying to serve thousands of kids every day. And the kids show up, but you've got to look at the human capital and how much he can really do as a staff of one and whatever young people he can sort of bring in from the program. You have a couple of young people here who are engaged in this work, and they're volunteers. They're not paid. You're going to say something?
I was going to say that part of the challenge is the recognition that our society believes that people act out of choice. And so we had a grant in working with Head Start, and I was in a Head Start classroom, and the teacher said at least 20 times in 20 minutes, you're making a bad choice. Now, the kids in that classroom weren't looking and responding every act, whether it was pushing a child or hitting a child. It wasn't, should I hit him or not? All right. Their brain was wired to view what was happening in a way that said, I'm at risk. And so it wasn't a 50-50 choice. And yet we punish children, and we have a society that views people are where they're at because they're choosing to be where they're at. And this is that much more troublesome and worrisome, everything you said, Carl, when it's children, because their brains haven't even developed fully. And yet we expect them to be able to make the right choice. And if we punish them enough, they'll learn to make the right choice. And what we've learned through research is, again, that creates more resistance rather than now suddenly I've seen the light, and now I'm going to do what I do. And that's why, again, to the state's credit, 15 years ago, they said, we're getting rid of boot camps because, quote, boot camps weren't working. If we could beat it out of them, then they would be able to learn what to do. But the brain says, the more I'm at risk, whether it's from people that are supposed to help me or not, the more I'm going to be in fight flight. And so this going back over and over, it's a paradigm shift for our whole country to recognize that trauma changes the brain.
And when trauma changes the brain, then we just don't tell a child, well, you should do this, and they're going to do it. It takes work. It takes energy. It takes repetition on in order to be able to do that rewiring. But our response is, well, we've given this. You should be all right now because didn't you learn this when we haven't recognized the root cause, which is how the brain has changed.
What's really frightening about what you've described is how many of you are familiar with the school-to-prison pipeline? And that basically they look at third-grade reading scores and they plan how many prisons to build or the size of prisons based on third-grade reading scores. And so when you think about it's what that sounds like, what it leads you to believe is that the expectation for those kids' success sort of ends at the third grade. And right now in Michigan, about 25% of the state budget, I believe that's the correct number, is the prisons budget. It's the single largest chunk of the state budget. It's for prisons. So 79% of fourth graders in Michigan are not up to reading levels. That's frightening. Eric, you're seeing some success in your work, and you talk a lot about relationships. And how difficult is it to build the trust necessary? Because, you know, what Jim is describing is, I've got to lash out before you come after me. I've got to strike first. But to build the kind of relationships you're describing that are providing some support for these young people, that requires such a high level of trust. How do you do that?
Well, so one of the things that you were saying that really stuck out, a lot of times when we talk about youth violence, we talk on a macro level. We talk about community, which then I think pushes us into those conversations about those people or, you know, us and them and that kind of a thing. Going back to the comment section like you were talking about, it's my guilty pleasure too. And
it's not a pleasure. It's just guilty.
It's not a pleasure, but why do I keep doing it? It's like that song on the radio that you don't want to listen to, but you leave it on. Like, that's what the comment section is. And so there was a raid, like a sweep this week, and I think there was like 30 people arrested and indicted. And they were, usually that headline would read Southwest Detroit, blah, blah, blah. You'd see streets that are familiar. You'd see names that are familiar. This said Detroit, Dearborn, Wyandotte, Lincoln Park. I don't even know how many other cities. So Lincoln Park showed up in force on the comment section to talk about how they felt about, you see, we give those people from Southwest Detroit a couple of our units and a couple of our apartments, and this is what they do with it. We give those immigrants, an opportunity to live in our city, and this is what they do with it. You talked about when people are in an environment of violence or trauma. I don't remember maybe it's both. You said there's one of three things that you do, and one is you run away from it, right? Sometimes it's your neighborhood, you run away from it. Sometimes it's a specific situation. You run towards it and meet it head on with what it is that's challenging you, or you become numb. All three of those, I think, have very negative consequences. But in particular, they have negative consequences when they are geared towards other people, because this will sound a little confusing maybe, and maybe it's because I don't know what I'm talking about, or maybe it's because it's a good thought and it's just not fully worked out yet. But other people's idea of other and what other people are, it can be very dangerous or it can be very uplifting. And so I think that a lot of our work in helping to build relationships is about starting to temper some of those expectations about other. Whether that's from a young teenager to start to think about their 85-year-old neighbors or to think about their neighbors that are their age. Our expectations are the root of our disappointments. If we can, temper our expectations, then maybe we can meet each other on a level field where we can, exchange some mutual respect. And while that mutual respect is being exchanged, we can build some relationships and also maybe some cool art too, in the process.
So if I just to make sure I understand you, basically you're removing the unfamiliar that could then be perceived as being dangerous. You try to.
I won't say that's what we're doing, but that's what we want to do.
So by making it more familiar, it becomes less dangerous, and then the relationship is able to be formed? Is that?
Sure. And like I said, with the project being inside out, we're very focused on our four stakeholder groups that make up the Alley Project. And those are youth from Southwest Detroit in general, neighbors, hyperlocally, people with a property that's adjacent to the Alley in between Falcon and Avis off of Ellesmere, and then organizations. Those are for-profit and nonprofit. Those can be partners, those can be supporters, you know, whatever it is. And then artists. And that's just in general, if you consider yourself a creative. So those four stakeholder groups come together, and we do needs audit, and we do an asset audit. And wherever there's overlap, we focus because there's already energy there. There's already capital there. You don't need a lot of money to make things happen in those places. And so, you know, we circle them, and we put a magnifying glass on them, and we try to figure out how to use those things to build unlikely relationships. It's not a magic bullet. It's not, you know, maybe even anything that would work on the other side of Southwest Detroit. But for our two blocks, it's been effective. When I'm walking through the alley and I hear, "Eric, Eric, Eric," I'm like, that sounds like an 85-year-old voice that really wants to talk to me. And it's Jim, my neighbor, with his head over the thing. He's like, "Hey, come over here." I'm like, "Oh, what are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, I'm just having a beer." I'm like, "Okay." I go over there, and he has three graffiti artists in his yard, in his garden, sitting there drinking wine. They were in their 20s, you know. I mean, it wasn't like 14-year-olds. He's like, "I'm building relationships here." but they were in his garden drinking wine with him, and they just ran into him because they were waiting for me, but they met when they were doing a mural at the thing, and they'd been hanging out for 2 hours. That's an unlikely relationship. That's healthy community building. That has some assets that we can take and bottle and put it on the shelf and then use it, you know, when we need it for something that maybe doesn't have to cost us a lot of money.
Carl, you started to say something.
Well, what bothers me, has driven me crazy over the last few decades, is that, and I love Eric, so I'm not talking about you, but what I am talking about is the lack of what I'm saying is it's how we treat in this city and other places, as Flynn and others, about poverty. You know, Gandhi was absolutely correct. He said the deadliest form of violence is poverty. We've been looking at poverty and blaming poor people and poor children, and they don't have anything, and people keep coming back with these ridiculous notions, whether they're sociologists or any damn body. There's no money, and there is no fun in being poor. And if you have to scrape pennies to get gas, it's not gas like I was when I grew up on the, you know, gas is, I'm all hell, 22 cents, 23 cents a gallon. Gas is $4 and so forth. And even to go to Burger King with a family to feed your kids, it's ridiculous. No one's talking about poverty. Fat guys are getting fatter and talking smack. And I mean that. I look at Cheney. I'm sorry. I'm apolitical. I don't give a damn if you're a Republican or Democrat or whatever. But I look at Cheney, and he said the war will pay for itself. Don't worry about that. People are coming back. The veterans are jacked in the head. They can't get service. Your children. Why don't I know about this guy more? I mean, he should be front and center talking all the time. I don't know this guy. Why don't I know this guy? I'm seriously.
Now you do.
Well, I mean, he's probably going to be sorry, but it's probably going to. But the truth is, what I'm saying is that poverty. I'm not talking to my university students. I'm not talking about ramen noodle poverty. I'm not talking about the care package that comes from your mom. I'm talking about dirt ball poverty. Children can't afford the damn shoes. There's a conspiracy, this neoliberal ideal. It's ridiculous. So you keep asking why this kid behaves this way, and the only success he or she sees is the titty bar, sorry, and guys rolling and having the cars and money. That's the only money they see.
So we've heard about this concept of the stickiness of poverty, which is especially for people of color, that poverty sticks to you. So even if your family, so let's say you're a generation removed from poverty, my grandparents were sharecroppers on both sides of my family. My parents were able to cobble out a working class life. I would be considered probably middle class. God, I hope so. But anyway, I do work for public radio, y'all. But I would be probably considered middle class. But it is more likely for me to return to poverty because I'm an African-American woman, and there's this lack of wealth in the African-American community. From your studies and what you've observed, which is stickier? Is it the poverty piece or the violence piece? I know they're inextricably tied together, but which is more difficult?
I think they're hand in hand. And I think the drastic change is, Jen, that the reality is that, and I don't know you, but young people are looking at folks, for example, in this city that were school teachers that are now marginalized themselves. 30 years ago, school teachers made respectable money and they had great benefits, and suddenly, so when you get poor, then it justifies the violence. That is the frustration that you have. I'm going to do something to somebody. Or you have the propaganda that you have on this great show on Showcase going on right now called Power, where this young African-American man is gorgeous as he can be, and he's having sex with beautiful Latina and black women. He's getting paid. And so the young man, regardless of where he's at, he's not getting any money. I'm sorry. He doesn't look at me. He doesn't see me as a big-haired professor. They have one question, and that is the question that makes this society run. Forget about all this rhetoric. Are you getting paid? That is what matters. Girls go and dance at places, and we allow them in our community. Are you getting paid? That's what this is about. And so I think that when you ask the question, I think it's attached. That the teacher, the school, I have a young woman who was a student of mine who is now telling me she's taking up. I'm sorry, adult entertainment sounds better. I know Pamela, get on me. But
we are taping this, Carl.
Okay, so I'm sorry. Adult entertainment. But she has a college degree, and she taught for 2 years, and then she got cut. And then she started working for a charter school. There, I said it. And so there's no money there either. So she's having a conversation with me. That's a real conversation. She said, well, Doc, I hear what you're saying, but I'm going to go dance. I make more money dancing. I'm like, you have a college degree. Well, you know what is bad, Jen, is that I'm hearing her, and I'm understanding her, and that scares the hell out of me. You know, does that mean that sooner or later I look at Eric and other young men, and they're not taking drugs. They're not taking drugs, but that's what a lot of people don't understand. They're not taking drugs. No, they're selling drugs, and they're willing to kill somebody over it, and then they look over at their brothers and sisters who have went to war, who've come back, can't get help. They're not getting money. So the name of this game is I'm getting paid. And so it's connected. It is connected to the two. That's what is going on my end. That may be the extreme to some of you. But I would say to both of you, you were in Flint, right? Okay. Mateen Cleaves and I were up there with a crew. And we went through a neighborhood. And they were saying to me, boy, God, Carl, looks scary. Look like nothing's here. And I said, there's plenty here. No, Carl, doesn't look like anything's here. I said, there's the. We got out. I said, you see where that car's parked? People are living in that house. People are selling drugs. Survival is an ugliness that bypasses all theory to me. And when you have survival as long as you've had, and it's not just Detroit. It's Newark. It's Compton. It's the south side of Chicago. All of you right now, if you've noticed, you want to talk about gangs, Angie? Then talk about the south side of Chicago. What do they call the south side of Chicago? Does anyone know here? That's right, Chirac. And they put. He brought out the National Guard 2 weeks ago. And guess what? They ain't winning. You can talk what you want. The bad guys or the ones that they're sitting are winning. And that's what the kid is looking at. Who's winning and who's getting paid?
So what do we, and I want to make sure that if you have a question or a comment, raise your hand, give us a wave, we'll pass the mic around. This is another thing we see play out, right? We hear people see the media, they see the news, and they say those are bad kids, right? These are bad communities. They don't say these are bad kids or good kids in bad situations or kids who could be good in bad situations. And so how do you balance out the need for punishment with prevention? Because people want streets to be policed. They want to feel safe right now. But at the same time, there's this ongoing cycle of trauma and violence that isn't being addressed. So what do you just say, okay, starting from 14, going back, we're going to help them, but the rest of y'all, we're just going to have to let it play out. Like, what do you do? What do you do?
Well, one of the things that we've set up here is
the word is resiliency. How do you build resiliency in our kids, all right, so that they have been through tough times, all right, because they live in a neighborhood? And that's something that your work about community, it's about how does a community build resiliency in our kids, and recognizing that they need relationships, they need to have some experiences of success, all right? All of us in this room, if we don't have success, what do? We quit, all right? You know, all our kids get, many of our kids, excuse me, get labeled as not caring, unmotivated. Well, why would you be motivated if you don't think you can succeed, all right? If I can sell drugs and succeed and get money, that's what I'm going to do. And so that's a huge part of this. And the other part of this is how do we help our kids? Because going back to the brain again is when you're in survival all the time, you don't learn how to regulate your brain. Because your brain starts from the top down to regulate. And so our kids do something, and again, I go back to everybody in this room. We've all been in situations where we could have lost it, but what? We said, no, settle down, don't do it, da-da-da. And we've learned, but if your brain is a five-year-old brain, you're going like this. And so we have to teach what we do to kids who've been exposed to violence and trauma is how do we create a new set of responses, not saying our society needs to be safe, not saying that there's a time to be able to protect society, but simultaneously, are we giving them what they need? And that's the real onus on all of us is we don't give them what they need. All right? We don't give them those experiences. Well, we said we send them to therapy, but therapy doesn't cure people. All right? It's the experience of relationship. It's the experience of success. And it's experience of I can regulate my brain to be successful.
So, Eric, if you had an unlimited budget, and maybe it's not a resource, I'm going to ask each of you this, so give it some thought, and you could give kids what they need. First of all, what are you hearing they want? What are they asking for? And what would you want to give them?
I don't spend a lot of time thinking about what I would do if I had an unlimited budget because our organization was founded in 2008, and on average, we've averaged about $40,000 a year for organizational budget. So any work that includes my pay, that includes the pay of it. Now, you said that they're volunteers. They're not volunteers.
Oh, no, just the kids in Flint.
Oh, okay, sorry. So, like, our young people, you know, we hope that eventually they get a little bit older, and then they work alongside us, you know, and so that money is split again. And then we have, you know, physical things that we need to do, like to the project, money gone. So I think you get into this cycle when you're thinking about grants and money where you want to say, okay, how do we get this money and how do we get as much done while we have this money, and how do we set ourselves up to go after more afterwards? Because we know that the reality is that we're not probably ever going to be heavily funded. It's just not really part of our strategy. What we try to do is we try to spend the money in ways that makes the program sustainable for X amount of years. And so our programs, like what I think makes us effective, I think starts when the money's gone, because we've used that money to facilitate processes. And what we're trying to do is cruise like off the social capital. So
if you had unlimited capital, maybe
yes,
that's the better word.
So that's where I was going. And what would I do? I think our work would actually probably shift a little bit, and it would be work that reduces feelings of otherness, like between folks. And we very much focus on connecting people and places of Southwest Detroit with people and places of other communities. And those communities aren't always geographic. You know, I mean, they can be, you know, age, sex, race, religion, you know, like your interests, you know, whatever it is. But I don't think that, and again, this is opinion, this is not research. Nothing is more valuable than experiencing different people in different places and being exposed to values like that are different than your own, while at the same time building relationships and having some accountability. Then everything's tempered, you know, and so I think that if we had unlimited social capital, that we would spend it on that work, and that would be a shift for us.
Hi, how's it going? I'm Freddie Diaz. I'm one of the TAP artists, and from listening to you guys, every one of you guys speak, I think I got answers to what you guys are trying to break. Being a youth growing up in the neighborhood, I have lived the life. I know the struggle. I have for never in my life have I used that as an excuse to succeed. I think that situations make you the person that you are, and we all have a destiny. And I think that the way that you guys are trying to help isn't really like help. It's kind of like a sobbing. You know, you ever have a sick friend and you know he's not going to last, like he's not going to live long, so you guys just kind of pat him on the back. That's how that feels when, like, you try to target, I guess you could say, a neighborhood that's filled with poverty. If you try to help them, you make them feel even more poor than they already are. You get it? So that's one thing. Another thing is saying, how much money does it take to change something? That's the thing. That's the mistake right there. There's no such thing as an amount of money to change. See, that opens up to a kind of world that we live in now. So it's like, how much money would it cost for me to change who you are?
Let me ask you this, Freddie. If it's not, and again, removing the word money and putting instead the word capital. So that can be human capital, social capital. I think that you are fortunate, and I'm just going to push back against you a little bit, because I also grew up in Detroit, and I know the number of people who made it out of my neighborhood, and I know how many didn't. And so I think that you have something that we call grit, which is a guy named Paul Tuff has done a lot of research about this, about kids who for some reason are particularly resilient and able to do what you did. But I think that's not the case for many other kids. They don't have that grit and that resilience to be able to break through. But sticking with what you said, what do you think needs to be done? Are you saying just leave it alone?
Well, listen, how many of those people that actually make it out of the neighborhood come back?
That's a fair point.
See, if you're able to make it and you pave a path, but you're not sharing your path, then how good of a path is it? You got to think about it that way, okay? It's not about money. It's not about capital. It's simply about building that relationship. In order to build that relationship, it has to be with somebody that's lived what you live. You get it? So if I have more money than somebody and I'm trying to tell them how to live, of course it's really smart of me to tell them how to live because I have the money, and that's basically speaking for me. Like, if I'm, hey, this is how you better your life. But if I don't live in the same environment and the same conditions that they've lived in, it's a whole nother world. It's going to go in one ear and out the other.
That comes to a point, Carl, you and I have talked about before, about how in earlier years you had mixed income communities where you had teachers and doctors and ministers living on the same block with people who were working more blue-collar jobs. And so there were examples of other ways of being and living, and that changed. Explain what happened in that relationship.
Well, and Freddie, I hope I can talk with you afterwards. I think that when that working class, the auto workers and those in that community that had gotten to a good point, sent their kids to college, when that came a loose, and you talk about coming back, many did come back, and they got the hell out of there because crime and violence, they, for whatever reason, they couldn't take it. I'm just saying they could not hang with that violence and what was going on. And in particular with schools, you want to put your kid in the very best schools, and the Detroit schools deteriorated. So there's a lot of, it's not simple to me. So I think what happened is that they left, and they left for good. Some moved south. Some, I call them diehards. I have some in my study that have done everything that you said. They're retired. One is a magnificent school teacher, 82 years old, and he's living in that house, and they're breaking into this. He has, the cavalry's not coming. The police don't come. And he's very bitter. So I don't think it's that simple. And I said to him, you need to get the hell out of here. Because now he's just become, he's preyed upon because he's old and weak. So that's what happened. They're not protected. They pay their taxes. They're good citizens. But nothing is happening good to them, so they have no choice but to leave. And I think that that's not cowardism. I don't think it's given up. I think that's the reality that many people live with.
I think, is it, hold on a second. You got it, Tony?
Hello? Okay. I think, the definition of a good school would be one that teaches high education, right? Correct? If I'm not mistaken.
Quality education.
But how many people are prepared for quality education? So let's say you tell me, I deserve to be in a good school. You put me in a good school. Do you think that I have the capability to survive in a good school? I would not be prepared. But knowing the stuff that I know, see the thing is, you going back to the story of you in the restaurant, the reason why those females were really, really cold, it's not because they've accepted it, or it's not because it's normal to them. It's because they know why it happened. See, a lot of the reason why there's crime in Detroit is because there's poverty. But the reason why there's crime is because there's people without jobs. There's people that are desperate. People look for ways to make money under the table than over the table. Because if you make money over the table, you're losing money, but you're knowing that you're making. But it seems a lot easier. So if you count the number of drug dealers in the city, I'd say you have a lot more drug dealers in the city than you have people with college degrees. But if you look at the roots of a drug dealer, that's basically an entrepreneur in the making that didn't have an opportunity to get their degree.
So, Freddie, if Detroit, for instance, and that's just used, I mean, there's a number of cities in the state that are, what I'm hearing you say is that it's not just about people being willing to live in the city. I mean, there has to be an infrastructure to support people being here. Because I think there are people who would probably come back if there were the jobs, if they felt like there were safe neighborhoods and good and schools where they could be comfortable sending their kids. But, you know, for the people who aren't living there or who have moved, I mean, I had to follow where a job was going to be. And it's something, honestly, that I struggle with, is whether I owe something to Detroit and whether I have a, whether it is my responsibility to live in the city, work in Ann Arbor, but just be in the city because, and that's something a lot of people struggle with, I think.
People confuse crime. I don't know. I think my mic turned off. But, oh, I'm sorry.
We'll come back to you next.
Oh, there it goes.
That's what I'm doing. I'm a graduate student in Michigan State, and I grew up here. So all the things that you're saying are resonating with me. So this idea of, thank you, of capital. But so I have social capital. I dare to say I'm middle class also, even though I live on a graduate student salary. But I endure a commute to East Lansing sometimes 2 to 3 times a week because I struggle with that. But I also am living in the house that I grew up in. So it's been 18 years of my life there. And I've come back to that community and something very interesting happened with the neighbor down the street, and so she's having a dispute with the utility company. And she, do you know someone? Do you know someone who's a lawyer? And by chance, I do. So I've gone to college. I have friends who've gone on to be lawyers. So I do have that sort of tangible connection for people in my community. So I want to stay there because of that. I have that sense of responsibility and obligation, but also as a middle-class person of means who worries about safety and services, those I have options. So I'm happy to report also that as of Saturday, I won a house in the auction, buildingdetroit.org, and in the Marygrove community where I live. And in 2 months, I hope to be living there. And not, and this isn't to knock Midtown or Corktown, but I'm living in a community that sort of isn't it, and I'm bringing my capital to bear, I hope.
So, okay, go ahead. No. Well, I was going to ask the next question to you, so you go ahead.
Well, I think the other part of this that we, and again, names help us define things, is historical trauma, all right? And historical trauma is when a people, and in certainly Detroit, African-American, and obviously I am privileged, I'm a white man, and I know that. But there's a history that goes with historical trauma that affects my survival, all right? And my world has been very different than your world. And I recognize that, but that affects what we do and how and what happens in a city. And I think the other part of that is then it creates a risk of survival because it quickly moves into, because your world necessarily hasn't been safe. And that is historical, goes way back to your sharecropper history and certainly whatever's there. And I think that's an important recognition that it's not just what's happening now. It's what's happened in the past, in the historical past, that affects where we're at right now. This isn't just an issue now. It's been an issue for a long time in our country. And I guess the other thing I just want to say, and Freddie, is that your name? I just want to say that. So thank you. But is I'm not here to make it soft on anybody. But what I'm here for is to help people understand what chronic exposure to stress, and that can be poverty, that can be trauma, that can be violence, what it does to the brain, because it doesn't make it equal, all right? So you have a rare gift, and you've had something because you got through a lot of things, all right? And that's a great thing that you're passing on to everybody else. But there are other kids, most kids don't have what you have. And so in that context, it's about how do we empower them? Because what I heard you say is you got to empower people, all right? And so, Jim, don't come into my neighborhood, all right, as a white man coming in here to say, do these things, you know, because you ain't going to make it, all right? And that's okay. But I also know that the way our kids are successful is when they feel empowered, that they can impact their environment in a positive way. All right? And I think that's what we're trying to do, but we can't see kids as equal to say, well, everybody's equal, because everybody's not equal, because of what's happened to them, and that chronic exposure has put them in a place that makes it that much more difficult. So when kids like you make it, that's an amazing thing, and that's great courage that you have and inspires all of us. But we're not trying to make it soft. We're trying to give kids a chance so that they can use the opportunities, not make excuses for them.
There's a question back here.
Okay, sorry. My name is Annie Allington, and hi, Dr. Taylor. And I'm the director of the Detroit Youth Violence Prevention Initiative here in the city of Detroit. And that's a partnership between the Department of Education and Department of Justice for like 10 cities, and we focus on this issue every day. You are talking my world. Like, this is what I live and deal with every day. I was actually a little late today. But the reality, one of the things you ask, and I could talk for hours and days about this, but I won't. First, I want to say, I think we should be careful when we really think that my experience is different from yours, because you don't know me. So when you begin to talk to people and communicate that way, you kind of put them on, because you don't know that young lady. We all have had different experiences, but I do understand the historical context that you were trying to go. But I think we need to be careful, because me, I was an African-American studies major for my undergrad, but a public policy for my grad. And what I will tell you is that I believe in the Booker T and the Du Bois, because the way I was raised. But you have to understand that we still have a personal responsibility. The only issue I have with the pipeline of Princeton is that when we communicate it to young people and then they try to, you know, they talk a lot about it, right, is that they somehow, and we allow it, remove the personal sense of responsibility and accountability. I get the whole, but we have to always have to have a personal sense of accountability for ourselves. When you think about violence, first I'm going to say, well, I've said a lot, but one of the things I will say, you asked the question, to answer your question, how much if you had an unlimited budget? Well, we have a decent budget. We have a ceasefire program. We have some school culture and climate programs now as we built up. We have safe routes we're working with. It's never enough money, but if I had to pick one thing, what I would do is invest in positive youth development. And what that would mean is exposure to, most of us think that means employment. It's not just, the kids will tell you they want to be safe, they want to be in a secure place, they want to be in a clean place, they want to be in a well-lit place. So I would create, I would spend as much money as the world would allow to spend. All of a sudden, I just had a Christmas movie in my head or something. But I would spend as much money as I can to create positive experiences. But also, what we did last year, creating a new normal. You got to get people to think, not think differently, but just think. Right? They'll make different decisions if they start thinking more. So, and then you start weighing your options. So is that positive youth development money, even though I'm a firm believer that the world is way more sexist than it is racist, and therefore, if you look at the root cause of some of this violence, domestic violence is right in the middle of it, and domestic violence affects all races, faith groups, economic backgrounds, all that. So it doesn't escape any of us in this room or in this city of Detroit or in this state of Michigan or this great nation. So when we think about that, we have to get people to start thinking differently and then begin to map a way out of poverty. One of the conversations I would like to love to have with Dr. Taylor is like, you know, this youth violence work now, to me, is almost like this trendy topic, right? And it's like, and I'm really into it. This is what I do, right? But it reminds me a lot of the conversation about teen pregnancy 15, 20 years ago, right? And so, and then, you know, so when you think about how, what's the next social issue for our young people? And so Henry Ford did a great, U of M student, med student from Henry Ford did an excellent study for us. I'll share with you guys if you guys want, especially Dr. Taylor. And he says, he did these on trauma and the violence and everything. And because we hear about the homicides, but it's those non-fatals that are really traumatizing, right? But he says, you know, it's all about, many people think it's about, not when we talk about black people, we talk about people of color, it's because you're a bad person. We talk about everybody else, it's because you're a sick person, right? But really what he said is right on, the whole trauma, the environmental and all that. But at the end of the day, he said, well, when you look, he took all these, you know, when you're a researcher, all these interviews, and when you begin to look at them and take them apart, he said the violence was a logical conclusion, and it frightened him. I mean, it was a logical, rational conclusion as to how this person was shot or was the perpetrator, a victim or perpetrator of a gunshot. That's just the gun. We ain't talking about the girl fights. We're not talking about the bullying. We're not talking about, I don't know if anybody ever seen some of these videos on the restroom. You know, I've seen somebody actually drop a cement block on the person's head. A student, it was a girl fight. And I was like, I couldn't believe it. And the first thing the law enforcement folks in the room said is that is attempted murder. But I bet you that young lady didn't know that. We have to talk to our kids. We have to get them to think, provide more exposure, have more youth voice so that we know what they want. It should be at least, you know, this room should be half filled with youth. You can't talk about this without, you would have called me, I would have got you some youth here. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't get it. But anyway, but I would definitely, I responded to someone who, and I told him I would be here tonight, but I would have definitely got more youth here, and we would love to do this again if there's an opportunity presented. So, and it's a lot, it's not just us. There's a lot of organizations in the city of Detroit that do this work and engage young people. But we live in the Motor City, and I worked in Ford Motor Company as a project development for design, product development design. And our corporations don't build or products or deliver services without the customer in mind. We have to listen to the young people and learn from them and say what works, what doesn't work, and if somewhere find a middle ground. Because I don't completely agree with the young man, but I know I hear him. I hear him. Thank you.
Going on time. I just want to make sure we... Okay, go ahead.
Mm-hmm. Am I... Okay, yeah. Sorry. He turned me off earlier, I think, because I kept tapping my microphone. I do that. I think he's like, shh. So, I'm sorry, I missed your name. Okay, Annie. One of the things that you were talking about is, I think, essentially talking about personal responsibility versus social responsibility. I've found a set of political podcasts that I can listen to without being nauseous, and so I listen to those, like, over and over, and I can listen to them on 2x speed. So I get to fast-forward over commercials, and I get to get through them, like, really quick. So I have a handful of conservative podcasts I listen to and a handful of progressive podcasts. And I had this, it was a quote from a man that I usually disagree with most of what he says, but I respect all of his processes. He said that the core difference between a progressive and a conservative is that a conservative believes that the world's great evil is within the individual, and a progressive believes that the world's great evil is within society, evil and responsibility. And so I think, I don't think that this was his point, but I think it's your point, and I think it's a point that I agree with, that we really need a balance, right, between those two, between personal responsibility and social responsibility. You talked about teen pregnancy, but that looked like 15 years ago when that was getting, you know, talked about. Sometimes it takes that limelight, right? It takes that all that, like, front page and being chic and being important and, you know, sexy and all that stuff to really pull, you know, everybody more closer to the middle. And, you know, maybe teen pregnancy's turn was, you know, 20 years ago. And I admit it's a little annoying when it's youth violence's turn, because, like, the way that things get talked about sometimes, you're like, oh, okay, you know, like let's get in there. But I'm happy about it because it pulls more people, you know, to the middle. So I just wanted to say that I hear what you're saying, and I think I agree. So. Right.
I don't want to be sexy. Don't make me your poster child for God.
No, but while it is sexy, like isn't it our job to try to shoulder our way into the table in a way that we get to plant our feet so that when it's not sexy anymore, we still have a voice?
Still at the table.
You know, yeah, and like still being at the table.
Yeah.
I don't know that I needed a microphone. I have a big voice. As you can see, I'm from Cass Tech. I'm the vice president of the Alumni Association. The young man up there used the word otherness. One of the things that I've been involved with for several years is desegregating schools. If the kids going to school could meet like I did when I went to Cass in 1948, leaving the Jewish community and meeting kids from all over the city, I realized that some of them I liked and some of them I didn't, but it wasn't because of their color or the way they spoke. It's what they did. So otherness is a big problem. Beyond that point, I will tell you that I'm a member of what's called the Neighborhood Activities Committee. We are a 16-member committee that works with the Illich people to develop input from the communities surrounding the new arenas so that people that live there get jobs, young people learn how to be tradesmen, young people get an opportunity to develop. And so I would like you all to know that the Illich folks in the neighborhood activities community are doing good things. I happen to be an electrical engineer, and I belong to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. And that union is working very hard to bring in young people to become apprentices and to get good jobs in this whole Illich development. So there is some positive things that are happening, and so keep thinking positively as you listen to all these ideas. Thank you.
Thank you. I think we are, oh, we have time for one more, and then we'll have to wrap up. Allie, right here.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Angie Reyes. I'm the Angie Carl keeps referring to. People are probably wondering, who the hell does he keep talking about, Angie? I'm from Detroit Hispanic Development Corporation and have been doing youth development in Southwest Detroit before that was the buzzword. And actually, Freddie is a graduate of our program. And Carl and I have been working on the issue of youth violence for decades now. And it's sexy again now. It's gone up and down in whether or not people were paying attention to it. And there have been times when I wish nobody would pay attention to it except the people doing the work, because the media sometimes is a double-edged sword, and I've seen it get kids killed because it was sexy, and they put some kids on the front page of a newspaper who ended up dead in a week. So it's not a new issue. It's been going on for a long time, and it is not, not surprisingly, it is connected to the economy. As the economy improves, gang violence goes down. As the economy gets bad, gang violence goes up. That's across the country. That's been historically the case. And we've been in a really bad economic downturn for a really long time, so we're experiencing a lot of youth violence now that we haven't seen. We didn't see it, I'm sorry, during the Clinton years, because the economy was really good back then. So, you know, it's not something that's new, but it is something that people are paying more attention to these days. And, you know, we know that federal and local policy have a lot to do with what's going on in our communities right now, and has led to the disinvestment in the city of Detroit, has increased the poverty in the city of Detroit. I believe it was somebody from PolicyLink, Angela Glover Blackwell, who talked about the fact that why do we see a decrease in resources going to children in our country today? If you look at the demographics, look at the birth rate right now, the majority of children being born in this country today are children of color, black, Latino children. The majority of the policymakers are white. They do not see their future in the faces of our children today. That is a critical point in whether or not they decide to do things all the way from putting money for student loans to resources for after-school programs. We're not important to them because we are othered. It is a whole society of others. So that plays a critical role. And the other piece I wanted to mention is the Center for Disease Control just issued a report about PTSD and its impact on young people growing up in urban societies. Unfortunately, they decided to call it hood disease, which in essence blames the young people who are growing up in that environment. But I've been saying for at least a couple of decades that we have whole communities dealing with post-traumatic stress. And they did find in their research that there is a form of post-traumatic stress that young people who grow up surrounded by violence experience that is much more chronic than that experienced by war veterans, because people who are in a war eventually leave it. Our young people don't leave it. It gets ingrained in how their brain is wired and how they grow up and how they respond to things from a very early age, and there is no escape for a lot of our young people. So that's recent research that just came out. Like other folks have said, I do believe that positive youth development is an important aspect of that, because the research also shows that love is an extremely powerful force to help undo a lot of the damage for young people. So being able to love them where they're at, exactly where they're at, as messed up as they may be at that particular point, I have seen people who have done decades in prison come back and be awesome role models for young people, because there's always hope for people.
Thanks, Angie. And it's interesting, and we're going to have to wrap up, but what we're seeing now is a trend towards a more public health approach to dealing with chronic violence in communities, and really looking at it as a public health problem rather than just a crime or violence problem. This time always goes way too quickly for me, but I want to give each of our panelists a chance to have a final word and just leave the folks who have joined us here this evening with something you think it's important for them to know. Eric, I'll start with you.
Okay. Angie, I'm just going to comment on part of what you said, because it's research-based and it's common knowledge that, you know, when the economy's down, you know, gang violence and violence in general is up. And when the economy's up, like, those things are down. However, even though that's research-based and it's common sense, I have to admit that I don't understand it completely. And I know that's a conversation that maybe we can have offline. But, for example, DHDC, if I'm remembering right, was founded during the Clinton years. Would that have fallen in Clinton's? Yeah. Okay, so you're right at the end of it. And we were there was more prosperity, but narratives in our community were still very destructive, and we had a need, you know, for a program, for an organization like that, that it served youth, and that served youth from a positive youth development perspective, not just from a perspective where, oh, these are adjudicated youth, or, oh, these are youth who are involved in gangs. And so one of the things that I have to say, I guess I'm just going to plug Southwest Detroit a little bit right now, is that we have an amazing network of nonprofits that are wholly committed to positive youth development. And sometimes we're not real good at it. Sometimes we mess up. Sometimes we do things that make really big mistakes, like, that we feel bad about. And sometimes we have really great successes. But we have a very strong core of organizations, of leaders within those organizations, of youth that are coming out of those organizations that understand and promote positive youth development. And that, like you said, that's not just about getting young people jobs. It's about meeting their core needs. Young people have developmental tasks that they have to accomplish. If they don't have a way to accomplish those in a way that's healthy, they will still accomplish it, even if they have to exploit themselves or somebody else. And so positive youth development programs, positive youth development initiatives, nonprofits that focus on positive youth development are about fostering those things in young people so that they can get the things that they need to develop, but also simultaneously contribute to themselves and the people around them, as opposed to getting those things by taking away from the people around them. And so I think that's part of why I don't have the understanding that I feel like I should about the correlation between, you know, the economy and violence. But that's how I wanted to end.
Sounds like a good follow-up conversation to have. Yeah. Jim?
So just two things. One, Sandra Bloom, who's the founder of Sanctuary, which is a trauma-informed organizational model, says hurt people hurt people. And I believe that. And as we understand what happens to our kids and what they do, it makes sense, as this lady said about the study at Henry Ford. So I think that's really important. The other thing is, and I want to return to what you were talking about, Jen, at the beginning of this is, you know, this is the choir, all right? And so one of the things that heals trauma that we know of is when children and adults can tell their story, and stories heal. And so it becomes our part. I know at our trauma center, what we try to do is we hear kids' stories and then we tell those stories so that we can heal to know we're all in this together. And it's all of our responsibilities to give kids a chance. So thanks.
Carl?
Wow. I appreciate the opportunity. I have to say, I'll probably run out the door. Because what I'm seeing is far worse than what other people are saying. And I've been doing this a long, long time. And I think that if we don't awaken and understand what is really out here, not for those who are successful in making, there are a lot of people that are totally disconnected, and the family is not there, there's no one there, and it has gotten much bigger in the last 50 years in many communities. And so I have to say that I'm praying. I told Jen, I was up north to get away from all of it. The technology has changed things. There are a lot of young people. But more importantly, I think the hypocrisy that I see in the moral leadership of this nation is just revulsive to me. It really is. And what I see is that you have created two cities in certain places, and you go past those places that people are living substandards. And I think a lot of you are going to look up and say, how did that happen? And we've ignored it all along. And so I hope that we awaken, but not to be the doomsayer, but it is much more jacked than what you want to believe. And I had a lady tell me yesterday, and she said, you know what, Taylor, I don't really give a damn what you say. I don't care about your public swimming pools or your public education, because I got a swimming pool at my house, and we don't care about any of that. We're tired of putting money into it. We're not doing it no more. And she's a very powerful person. Pamela has fought with me for the last, 12 hours for me not to out her. She's a major public figure. But I'm saying, well, if that's the attitude, it's us versus them, and this is what you're saying, then I'm really frightened. So I'm sorry to end it on that note, but I ain't feeling it. Young people, old people, whatever, I've been out in here. And Jen, someone asked me on your program, how do I feel? Because I come from this. When I returned to my old neighborhood that was working just fine, working class folks, I feel like I'm returning and looking at a chalk outline of a dead body. That's what I feel like. So some people say, Angie, I should get out the game, but Angie, I just told her, I'm not getting out the game. I'm gonna leave here, but I'm gonna be honest. I have to be truthful. And what I'm seeing is not what a whole lot of the folks are seeing. Bless you.
Don't drop the mic there, Carl. You know, this has been a challenging subject for us to tackle. Sarah and I, we have a show coming up on Thursday. It's a call-in show. I hope you'll all tune in, because this is really the beginning of a larger conversation, some to do with youth violence, but really dealing with the larger issue of child poverty in Michigan. And as we heard, those two things are inextricably tied together. This has been challenging for us because, unlike some of the other shows we've had where we've been able to end on this note of, but here's what's working. When we look at the large scale, we were like, wow, there's not a whole lot that's working or that we know to do comprehensively to deal with this issue. So as I believe Jim said, and as I said at the beginning, I'm assuming most of you here are the choir members. And so it is my hope that this conversation doesn't end here, that it doesn't end on Thursday, and that where it is in your power to share some of what you've heard here today, or maybe get involved with some of the organizations that are doing this work. Because as Jeffrey Canada said, we spoke to him last week, he's the founder of the Harlem Children's Zone. It's all our problem. It's all our problem. And while we may think we can live in our neighborhood or our community, it's all our problems. So on that cheerful note, thank you so much for joining us this evening. Thank you to our panelists, Eric, Jim, Carl. Stay tuned for other issues and ales that will be coming up, and we hope to see you again, everybody. Thanks so much.